I think this may be a short-ish talk, but I also think there might be some room for questions, which of course aren't required, but are always welcome. Recently, one of our students, I think through almost happenstance, came across a book that and told me about it during an online Dharma dialogue. It's written by Joan Sutherland, and the name of the book is Through Forests of Every Color, and the subtitle is Awakening with Koans. Joan Sutherland is a Zen master in a Japanese tradition, and as some of you know, at least through hearsay, the way koans are worked on in either the Japanese Rinzai tradition or the Soto religion, Soto sect that uses koan training, they're done in a different way than we do it. I'll just leave it at that. If you're new to koans, well, it's not a book report, and I'm not asking anyone to go out and read it, but I have found it quite interesting. It talks about working with koans, but the examples are ones that are probably a little bit different than the way we work on them. But there's a section in here that I wanted to read and then maybe give some short commentary on. And if people have questions, I'd encourage that. It's from a section called Off the Cushion, and it talks about how we can practice with koans when we're not in formal practice. And I'm a big advocate of that. I think people work on them in different ways. Recently, when I went around to see three Zen masters, they were all in a Soto tradition that used koan training. And some of these style of koans I got a chance to work with these amazing teachers. I'm not going to go into that part of it, but what I do want to talk about is how do we integrate koan training into our practice and into our life? I know a number of people have great consternation about doing koans, despite how good they are at it sometimes. And if I have an agenda, I guess the agenda is to try to encourage you to try it. I think most of the resistance to koans is they take away the control that we think we have in our lives, which is largely an illusion. We do have some control, but not as much as we like to think we have. And they also take away, you really need to work on koans, not through your deductive reasoning skills or logic. It doesn't mean they're divorced from it, but really a helpful way to work with koans is to sit with them, keeping the question alive, as opposed to grasping after something that will be called a correct answer by the teacher that you're working with. Anyway, I'm going to read this section and make some comments after that. She writes, when it's time to rise up off the cushion, take the koan with you. Carry it around in your pocket. Take it for a run or into the bath or to sleep. And then she repeats a question that's in their tradition. I would say something like an example of this was Jiaozhou said woo when a monk asked if a dog had Buddha nature. Why did he say moo? Why moo? Why moo? Why? Keeping this question alive is what she's pointing to. If in the beginning you find yourself trying to reason your way through a koan, do it walking around instead of on the cushion, freeing your sitting meditation for what happens best there. Exhaust thinking about the koan, which is quite natural, especially in the beginning, and see if you can start thinking and running and sleeping with it. Eventually, with a little luck, you'll be thinking and running and sleeping as it. In other words, your distant self looking at you practicing the koan will start fading away and you will become intimate with the question that you're working on. She continues to say, this is as important a part of keeping company with the koan as still meditation. The idea is that we live with this complicated, noisy, movement-filled, emotion-filled, thought-filled world, a giant field of things constantly rising and falling. We're hoping to be increasingly at ease with the world as it is, which means looking for the through line underneath sound and silence. The through line underneath sound and silence. Between motion and stillness. Keeping company with a koan, sitting and standing, walking around and lying down, is a way to stay connected with that through line. And over time, we no longer need the special circumstances of quiet and stillness to touch it. In other words, we can work on this koan by coming back to it over and over and over again, right in the midst of our lives as we live it. It doesn't require us to be in a formal sitting situation or quiet in order to review this question and keep this question alive. I'll come back to more of that in a minute. As you bring your koan fully into your life, bring your life fully into the koan. A woman who knew she was gradually going to go blind asked for a koan to keep her company as it happened. She was asking the koan to help carry her burden. And she was also willing to let the koan change how she experienced the burden. Your response to the koan isn't just a phrase or a gesture you express during a Dharma dialogue. It's everything that happens while you live with your koan. Notice what's arising or changing or being revealed in your life, what's suddenly demanding attention or becoming crystal clear or irrevocably falling away, even if it seems unrelated to the koan. The connection just not might not be obvious at first. I think what I love about this passage is that it's an invitation to not only open ourselves up to koan training, but also not have it be put in some special separate subsection of the life you live. We know as we practice Zen that everything's intimately interrelated. So this koan that you're working on, whatever it is actually not limited to the small self. If you can open up the question and you can open yourself up to your life as you're living it in a broad sense, which means everything you interact with, this koan can become part of that as well. I think one of the things I like about her phrase, carry this koan with you, put it in your pocket, whether literally, if you can't remember the question you're asking, you can print it out and put it in your pocket. But if you really work this way, you will know it by heart very, very quickly. I think different practitioners work on koans in a different way. And I think a number of you know, I've probably talked to most of you about how I do it. But I had a familiarity with what she was talking about because I usually, if I have a Dharma dialogue and I'm working on a koan and I come back to the room during a retreat or formal practice, usually that question is kind of alive and there's a lot of energy around it when I come to sit back down to continue my sitting meditation, and that wears out over a time, you know, during the retreat. But for a few minutes, it's very alive for me because I have no idea how to answer it. No idea where to grab hold of it. But after the sitting, after the retreat, as I go about my day and week, there is so much time to just bring the question up again. And I like to bring it up during what you might call in-between times, times where there's not much going on. You know, that great place you just left, and the great place you're going to, you haven't gotten to yet. There's this incredible amount of time to just bring your koan question up and keep it alive. Then you get to that great place you're going to, do whatever you're doing there. And then you have another in-between time when you leave and go back home. If you're waiting in a line at the grocery store, you can bring that question up, just engage it fully while you're waiting, and then you can let it go. To me, one of the things I've noticed is something is going on if I keep the question alive periodically. I don't know how and I don't know where, but I always kind of think of it as this question is gestating, something's happening subconsciously. And when you come back to it, you might notice you have a different relationship to it. Some kind of clarity may have come up, whether it's right or wrong. But you can bring that to the teacher and then take it from there. This idea of, or this notion that I've kept about keeping the question alive and letting it gestate, let it develop, let something happen, reminds me, and you might have heard about this, but it reminds me of a hen sitting on an egg. If we go into the Dharma dialogue room with our ego ready to either conquer the world or be sent away in shame, which our egos are all fragile at the end of the day, what we're looking for is positive feedback from the teacher, or at least a feeling when we come back and sit down and resume our meditation that we've done a pretty good job, whether we got it right or not. Yeah, that was a pretty good showing. That's all ego. And we all have it, and we're all human. And that, to me, is kind of the hurdle that we have to wear out if we really want to dig into koan practice. But getting back to this hen and egg analogy, a hen does not for a moment let the thought of her egg go out of her mind. How do I know this? Because I know how hens think. That's another talk. Okay, I don't. But there's great instinctive care that a hen always keeps the egg warm. Hen always makes sure that it's well cared for. And are we okay? Can I keep talking? Can you still hear me? Hello? I'm hearing this. Can you hear me? Okay.
Your mic isn't really picking that up.
Oh, okay. Sorry, we have some kind of alarm, smoke alarm or something going on. The point I wanted to make was what the hen doesn't do, it doesn't force things. It sits on it and it lets nature take its course. And the egg hatches and a chick comes out. Something fully formed comes out of that process. I'm sure people who raise poultry know how long the egg is there before it hatches. But the hen, I bet, doesn't. The hen just does her job. And I think this idea of being comfortable sitting with this question in a state of not knowing is really valuable, just as valuable as clarifying the koan and passing it, whatever that means. Why? Because this koan has put us into what we call don't know mind, and I want to make sure to define that. We have a couple of people who probably don't know that, but this mind that just perceives, that doesn't rely on our conditioning, our belief system, our philosophy of life, our sense of self, the things we like, the things we don't like, all of our conditioning doesn't help us, and all of our cognitive deductive reasoning really doesn't go very far with this. What we have to do is we have to be in this state of not knowing, where we're awake, we're present, we're engaged. Not knowing, as those of us who've been around here for quite a while, or maybe not so long, was what Zen Master Sung San, our founding teacher, said was the only thing he ever taught. Always returning to this mind before cognitive thought splits everything into this and that, brings us back to our direct experience. And the point I want to make about that is that, and I've talked to a few of you about this, I think that's as valuable as anything, learning to trust this mind that's before thinking, learning to know through your own experience that you can actually clarify things, not by some means other than your deductive reasoning skills, your logic, your beliefs, and your force of will. Can you sit with it and let something come up for you and then bring it in to the teacher? Also, when you come into the Dharma dialogue room, if you feel like you don't have any, it's okay if you do this, but when you come in and announce ahead of time, I don't have anything, that's okay to say. Absolutely okay to say. It's human, but don't give up on the possibility that something is going to arise in the moment. It can happen. It does happen. So those are probably a number of random thoughts, but I've been really intrigued by this, the experience I had going around to see these different teachers in different traditions was a little bit daunting, because as somebody said, it's an away game. But it was so rich. It was so rich to come into that practice in a different tradition as a relative beginner in their style of working on Kong'ans. And it really has energized me around that practice. I think I am the all-time self-proclaimed poster boy for people who started out practicing and was absolutely terrified of going into the Dharma dialogue room. And I've come to appreciate it so much. So my encouragement comes from my own practice over the years, seeing how that abject terror can be tamed and this incredibly rich curiosity can come out of that very thing. So it's okay if you don't like koans. Nobody's going to force you to do it, but it's such a rich aspect of our tradition that I really think it's important for people to try it. And I won't love you any less if you don't. So I don't know if this sparked any questions. We can talk about that. And if you want to get back to your sitting, we can do that as well.